Warning, this episode of Behind the Curtain contains discussions around drink spiking. If you or anyone you know needs support, you can reach out to Lifeline via 13 11 14 and lifeline.org.au or the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline via 1800 250 015. Viewer discretion is advised. Welcome to Behind the Curtain with Nick Troon, the show where we sit down with theatre practitioners and get a backstage look at the creative process. On today's episode, we sit down with Dr. Richard Jordan, a lecturer in theatre studies here at the University of New England. We'll be taking a look through Dr. Jordan's past works and his journey leading up to where he is today. So, without further ado, let's get on with the show and peep behind the curtain. Welcome to Behind the Curtain with Nick Troon. My name is Nick, I'm your host, and today I'm sitting down with Dr. Richard Jordan, a lecturer here at the University of New England. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First off, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a playwright and theatre scholar. I'm originally from Brisbane, and I moved to Armidale about 6 years ago to teach here at UNE. And before I entered the academy, I worked mainly as a playwright and theatre producer.
Starting way back at the beginning, when did you first get into theatre?
I guess every playwright's journey is quite different. I started as a writer in general. So growing up, I would write short stories and poetry. In fact, my undergraduate degree was in creative writing, actually. And in that degree, we did journalism, we did creative nonfiction, we did every type of writing we could. And then there was one playwriting subject in that course that I absolutely loved. I had dabbled in playwriting over the years up to that. I did drama at school. When I was 11, I wrote a musical that I forced all of my friends to rehearse for about 4 months every Sunday afternoon. And then we all performed it in front of our parents. I don't know how I stayed friends with everybody because I was quite dictatorial. So I'd always dabbled. And then finally, when I was about 20, 21, I sort of went, you know what, actually I want to specialize in playwriting because I love dialogue. I love writing dialogue. That's my favorite thing to do. And it's the way that I get into a story. So once I know a character's voice, how they speak, that's sort of my way into exploring their world and the story and what might happen to them.
So following on from that, when you started out as a playwright, you were lucky enough to be involved in a young writers program in London, right?
Yes. So that's fast forwarding a little bit. So that was when I was about 24. So in the intervening years, I did a master's actually in playwriting at QUT in Brisbane. And I sort of wrote my first full length play there. And I had it staged in the independent sector in Brisbane, 2005. And that was a play called Like Dead. It's a weird title, Like, comma, Dead. I'm a bit embarrassed looking back on that play now. It's very much a young person's play. Weirdly, it's my most produced play because it's had three productions, two in Brisbane and one in Hobart as recently as 2015. But young people seem to like it. I guess maybe that's, I don't know, because I was young when I wrote it, maybe. So that was like an absurdist comedy about denial, including a dead body who's in denial that he's dead. And that play got me into something that doesn't run anymore. It's called World Interplay, and it was an international young playwrights festival that used to happen in Townsville, actually, of all places, every 2 to 3 years. So Like Dead got me into that festival, and while I was there, there were people from all over the world, including the Royal Court Theatre in London, and that's where I was introduced to their young writers program. I sort of first heard about what it even was, and that's when I had a goal. I was like, okay, I need to move to London before I turn 25, because that's the cutoff for the program, so I can take this program. So that's what I did.
So what did the application process for that look like?
I think, again, I submitted the same play that got me into play. You just had to had evidence that you'd written before, but otherwise they were pretty open. They wanted to encourage really emerging writers, so you didn't have to be professionally produced or anything to get in. You just had to submit some material, show that you could write in general, and then they took care of the rest. And then there were actually two programs that I was involved with. That initial one, which I took when I first moved to London in 2006, 2007. And then I was actually invited back for an invitation group in 2008. And that was really exciting because they sort of saw potential in what I was writing.
And so what did that sort of program entail? Like, was it sort of workshop style things?
Is that it was weekly workshops. So it wasn't like a full-time study program. I was working full-time at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I would go to this program, I don't know, it was Monday nights or something like that. And it was at the theatre. So we all got free tickets to Royal Court Productions throughout their season. We'd have other outings. Sometimes the best part about the program was actually going to the pub afterwards, because the workshop, you'd learn stuff, but then you'd just sort of chat with your peers and chat with your tutor in the pub afterwards, and you'd learn a great deal there as well. For me, it changed my life, actually, that program. It sort of made me think about playwriting from a completely different perspective. I always say I was sort of grappling in the dark as a playwright before I did that program. And then after I did that program, I started to know what I was doing a bit more. You know, I was much more intentional with my choices.
Did you find that that program started to connect you to any sort of professional resources?
It did and it didn't. I mean, I was lucky enough to have a public reading at the Royal Court in 2007. I think it was ended 2007, which was pretty exciting. And I had a workshop. We got some actors together. Yeah, I met a director somehow. Gosh, all these memories I haven't thought about in years. And we spent a week rehearsing the play, and I was making rewrites. It was some kind of rehearsal space in East London. And I just remember just that week of working on it with these actors, it really was so exciting. And it was like everything I'd ever wanted to grow up and be was in this really creative space working on this new work. So that was very exciting, actually having it staged. But I was only there on a 2-year visa, so I couldn't really make long-term connections or look ahead too much into the future. But, you know, I certainly learned a great deal while I was there.
Whilst in London, you wrote a play called 25 Down. Was that the one you were talking about?
It is, yeah.
Yes. Now, it got a public reading in London, as you said, but it wasn't until you came back to Australia that you were able to see it worked into a full-scale production. Firstly, for our listeners, what is 25 Down about?
So 25 Down, I mean, it's not about crosswords. It is about quarter-life crises, about everything going downhill after you turn 25, you know, the idea of, you know, you're over the hill by then or whatever. But it also was mainly about an intergenerational conflict that I had observed in London, actually, between two very different generations. So I'd only just come out myself as gay about a year or two beforehand. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, I really noticed this clear division between younger and older generations of gay men. So my generation was really the first to come of age when being gay was not illegal in Australia, in Queensland anyway. It hadn't been illegal in the UK for decades. But nonetheless, even though it wasn't illegal, of course, since the 1960s in the UK, there was still a lot of stigma around it, and then the AIDS crisis and whatnot, and people my age and growing up hadn't lived through that. So we had a very different experience, and of course that's only been exacerbated since then. People, you know, half my age have hardly any of the hang-ups that I have, you know, so or maybe they do, I don't know. But things change, and the play actually came about because I remember I was out at a nightclub in Soho one night, and an older man came on to me, and I wasn't interested in him. And he went on to spike my drink. Ooh. And I know he spiked my drink because I'd only had half a drink and suddenly I was on the floor. And my flatmates thankfully rescued me. And he was trying to help and, well, quote unquote, help. And they got me out of there and got me home. And then the next morning I sort of woke up and was kind of going, what on earth was that about? And it almost felt like he wasn't even trying to have sex with me. It was almost like an FU, you know, because I'd rejected him. He was spiking my drink to sort of make sure I had a terrible night or whatever. And that antagonism was really awful, but also interesting. I was like, where is this coming from? Why did he respond in that way? And so for me, that was the seed. And I also wanted to explore, I guess, my own inner conflict about my own identity as well. So this is a very long-winded version of the play synopsis, but it's basically about someone turning 25 or in that age bracket who begins to make these sort of self-destructive choices. And it's told across 25 scenes. So it's like a bit of an expressionist drama, I suppose. And he's flatmates with an older man who's in love with him and who's trying to seek out for him. And there's this conflict between them. And really, it's about what did it mean to be gay at that point in time? And what do we owe the people who come before us?
Coming back to the production process, on this show, we talk all the time with directors and actors, but we very rarely talk with playwrights.
Yeah, right.
Could you talk us through the production process leading up to opening night of 25 Down?
What happened with 25 Down is it actually won an award called the Queensland Premier's Drama Award, which is still running today. And it's unique in Australia where when you win this award, you're guaranteed a production. That is so rare. So even the Patrick White Award that STC runs, they don't guarantee a production. And very rarely do they produce the winning play. But the Premier's Drama Award in Queensland does. So I flew back to Brisbane. I was shortlisted. I was in part of the workshopping process. It's almost like fight to the death playwright all-stars or something. As, you know, there were public readings of the three plays. And anyway, by 2008, I had won. And then in 2009, I was in Queensland Theatre Company's season. And so I sort of went on this development process throughout, I guess, the prize. And then once it won, it became, okay, I've been commissioned now. Now this is actually happening. And, you know, I was 25, really. I was 26, but I was in my mid-20s. And it was quite intimidating. You know, I remember it had a $150,000 budget, this production, which for me sounded extraordinary because the last play it had before that had run for 4 nights at the Judith Wright Center and had no budget. So, you know, in the space of 4 years, suddenly I was working at this level and it was very intimidating. The play wasn't really finished yet because most of the time with a play, when it's premiering, you're making changes right up to opening night. So that was a lot of pressure, and it had to be a success in my mind anyway, because all these resources, all this money was being spent on it. I had 7 in the cast. I had a great director. And so for me, what happened was I would write a draft. We would have another table reading. We'd workshop it. I'd go away for another few months. I'd come back. So we kept doing that. And then there was a 5-week rehearsal process in the lead up to opening night. And by that point, the play had to be in pretty solid shape. I could still make changes, and I did. But by that point, you can't make too many changes or else you're going to throw everyone off. And the last thing you want on opening night is a nervous actor.
Yeah.
You want the actors to feel confident that they know what they're doing and that what they're doing is going to work. Because if they have confidence, then the audience has confidence. And anyone who's worked on a new play before, it is very, very different to working on a play that's been established and tried and true. This is a bit off topic and random, but I've been listening to the Barbara Streisand memoir recently, and she was talking about when Funny Girl premiered on Broadway, and before that, they'd been workshopping it out of town. And during that process, I'm probably misremembering, and someone listening who's also listened to this memoir will go, you said the wrong number. But in my mind, I think she said there was something like 52 different final scenes. So they just kept changing the ending again and again and again based on audience responses until they got it right for opening night on Broadway. Now, Australian theatre or most theatre does not have the luxury of that kind of process. You've got to workshop it without an audience, just going on instinct and going on what you're getting from the cast and your director. So there's a lot of pressure to get it right on opening night. I think we had 2 or 3 preview nights before opening night. So I did make the odd change then, but otherwise it had to be pretty much in shape by day one of rehearsals. I was still making changes in that first week. Then I went away. My director, who was great, and he had no problem with me being in the rehearsal room. And I actually think it is a playwright's right to be in the rehearsal room for the premiere of the work, you know, as long as they're not getting in the way and being annoying. But if you're a conscientious, diligent, good playwright, you know how to work. I must say I did make one mistake, and I was young. An actor came up to me for a line reading once, and I gave them what I thought in my mind how the line should be said. And then the director came up and said, oh, guys, what are you talking about? And he didn't like that I was talking to them without talking to him first.
Of course.
And that was a really important lesson for me. And it wasn't about ego. It was about making sure that the messaging that they were receiving was consistent. So even though I might be thinking in my head, X, Y, Z, going through the director is so important because then they can communicate that message at the right time and at the right place, and also just through general kind of collaboration and talking it through. Because what makes sense in my head on the page might not make sense in this particular production. And so I had to learn that. But overall, I had a very positive experience with my director. He was really accommodating. And whenever I wanted to change, he was fine with it. And he was like, no, this is your play. We want to see it through. And this is the premiere of that work. I remember there's a scene where there's a secondary character called Emma, and we're seeing her on a bad first date, and they're at a bowling alley. And my director, John, even asked me, what color do you see the bowling balls being? And I knew the answer to that. I said, oh, they're sort of hyper-colored and ridiculous. And he went, okay. And then he turned to the designer and he said, can I have hyper-colored bowling balls? So, you know, it was a really great experience for me.
Coming back to that director, of course, this one was directed by John Halpin.
Yes.
How did it feel giving over that text to somebody else?
As I say, it was very positive because we were in constant communication with each other. Where things go wrong with playwright-director relationships is when you stop talking to each other. Or I guess when egos get involved or whatever. But there was always open communication between John and I, whether I was in the rehearsal room or when I wasn't. And, you know, I came back then, I think, the week before we opened. The night before opening night, I did change one more line, the final line for one of the main characters, because the line we had there just wasn't working. And the actor had said, look, this line feels weird for me to say. And at all times, at that point and at every other point, it was a really clear collaboration between me and the director and the actors, but working through the director, so that messaging was clear. So I know that a lot of playwrights, not a lot, but some playwrights have nightmare experiences with directors where they're just cut out from the rehearsal process completely. They're ignored. They turn up on opening night and they go, this is not the play that I wrote. That was not my experience. I had a really great experience. And actually, I've had a great experience with all of my directors now I think about it. So I've been very lucky in that way.
Moving on, after 25 Down, you were involved in a series of projects with your next major production being Machina. Now, this text tackles a whole new range of topics and issues. Again, for those unfamiliar with the play, what is Machina about?
Yeah, so Machina was a very different play. So where 25 Down was sort of gritty social drama and comedy as well, Machina was sci-fi. I became interested in something called post-humanism, actually, which is something I still research today as an academic. And really, I guess it's sort of interested in the relationship between humans and technology. That's sort of one big branch of post-humanism. So the play focuses on, basically, you have to imagine a world where it's possible to upload your consciousness into the internet, essentially, destroying your body in the process. So what would happen if someone uploaded their brain to the cloud, essentially, and their body died, but their consciousness remained?
Yeah.
And so the play looks at six people who have some kind of connection to this man called David Sargent, who has done this before the play begins. And it's about them looking to ascertain the quality of their own connections with other people. Basically, the play is interested in what does intimacy look like in the digital age. So we look at his mother, we look at his sister, we look at his ex, we look at a friend of friend, a friend of friend of friend. You know, I was sort of interested, it was sort of the early days, I guess, of social media and Facebook, and I was interested in those experiences where you don't really know someone, but you get caught up in the drama or whatever they're going through. And that was kind of new at the time, and I was interested in what that meant for human relationships.
Because remind me, what time frame are we talking here? What year did Machina first get produced?
So Machina wasn't produced till 2014, and I started writing it in 2011. So it was still kind of early days. So we're so au fait with all that now. But at the time, these were still new questions.
And how do you think that that text is now reflected given the new sort of media landscape that we're in today?
I would love to see the play produced again, actually, because I guess I'm biased, but I think it was really prescient. You know, a lot of the things that the play talks about that seemed very sci-fi have actually come true. Not the uploading the consciousness part, but everything else. For me, it was sci-fi, but only maybe one more step beyond what we were already going through. And really, the sci-fi aspect was really metaphorical for something that was already really genuinely happening. And of course, has continued to do since then.
Seeing that this was now your second time being involved in a major production of your work, did you see any differences between the production process of 25 Down and Machina?
Yes, there was a big difference. The main one was that I came on as producer for Machina. So I didn't produce 25 Down. I was just the playwright. And as there was big budget, lots of money, lots of resources, there were posters all over the city. This is in Brisbane. And that was quite overwhelming. But then by the time Machina came around, I worked with La Boite Theatre, which is the other second main theatre in Brisbane. And I decided to co-produce that one. And also I chose my director. So I had a lot more power, I suppose, where QTC, it was just luck that it turned out great. And we won an award the next year at the Matilda Awards, which are the Queensland Theatre Awards for Best New Australian Work. And that was terrific. I was really happy with that production. But as I say, I was just very fortunate because there were a lot of external forces beyond my control. So with Machina, I wanted to have a bit more creative control, I guess. So on the downside, I also had to put up some money. And we also won an award for Machina as well the following year after it was produced. And I remember when I gave my acceptance speech at the awards, I said I was so relieved that the play did well because if it didn't, I would have had to sell my car. The realities of making a buck in theatre, hey?
The ways that we get things by.
Totally. So, but fortunately, we did sell well and all was fine.
And so what did it mean for you being a producer as well as the playwright?
Well, there's lots of different pressures because when you're the playwright, you have the luxury of just thinking on a poetic level. So the world of the play is like this and don't bother me with real world problems, you know, but I just want to live in my dramaturgical fantasy, which is great. And that's actually what the playwright's job is. But when I had to take that hat off and then put on my producer's hat on, suddenly I had to make this happen, you know. So there were logistical things to consider in terms of our set budget, our marketing budget, our use of space, how many actors we could afford, you know, all these real world tangible considerations.
Yeah. Now, shortly after Machina, you took the step into tertiary education with a position here at the University of New England. What pulled you towards this decision?
So I wrote Machina while I was doing my PhD at the University of Queensland. And it was during that time that I first started teaching, really, as a casual at UQ. I'd done a bit of casual teaching at QUT as well over the years. But it was, I guess it was during that time that I first started to take it seriously. Working in the theatre is so precarious. Yeah. It's really precarious. As a creative person, I found some people respond to the pressure of churning stuff out to make money or to pay their rent quite inspiring. I don't. I found it quite stressful, actually. So I decided I really needed a day job as well as an opportunity to continue my writing career. And academia for me was a natural fit. It's not for everyone. Not every playwright or creative person works well in academic life. You have to use two different parts of your brain. When you're working as an academic, as a scholar, as a lecturer, you're using one side of your brain. When you're working as a creative person, you're working as another. But what I did learn in my PhD was that actually those two don't have to be separate, sort of scary ways of working. They can actually cultivate each other, I suppose. So if you are working quite creatively just in the industry, sometimes you have a bit of, I guess, that grappling in the dark idea that I talked about earlier. You're making decisions, but you're making them just on instinct. You don't quite know why you're making them. And by the same token, if you're working in academia and you're working in a field such as theatre and you don't really have a lot of practical experience, you know, there are really great scholars out there who do that and they work purely in theory. But I knew for me to be meaningful, I needed to think about the theoretical aspects of theatre with that practical knowledge. So I guess what it came around to is that A, practical reason I needed a day job, but B, you know, I could have had a day job anywhere. B, I chose academia because I liked the fact that I could use those different parts of my brain and then I could hopefully become a better scholar through being a playwright and become a better playwright through thinking critically about what I was doing.
Absolutely. It's coming at it from a completely different perspective.
Exactly.
Following on from that, for many people outside of the theatre community and even some within it, a degree in theatre can be seen as superfluous in comparison to practical experience. Already briefly talked on this, but what do you believe to be the unique benefits of dedicated study towards a theatre degree?
The first phrase that comes to mind is avoiding reinventing the wheel. So I think it's so important to know the canon and to know the tradition that you're working in and the field you're working in. And you can do that as an autodidact. You can do that just through, you know, doing your own research. You can do that. But our lives are so busy and chaotic. And if you are working in the theatre and you're just going from show to show, who has the time for that? And where do you even begin? So I like the structure of higher education. And we don't pretend to say this is the entire history of Western theatre in 3 years. We only ever have time for the greatest hits. But at least we're opening a door for then you to actually investigate those further and allow people to have a broad sense of the traditions, the history that they're working in. Because I think that that makes contemporary work stronger. Because, as I say, you're not thinking that you're doing something new and fantastic and it's been done a million times before. By the same token, you don't want to feel weighed down by history. You don't want to sort of feel like, oh, it's all been done. What is there new to do? And I must say, I'm always thinking about what makes theatre new. That, for me, that's exciting. So that's my own particular approach to theatre. Not everyone's interested in that, which is fine. But for me, how we continue to innovate the form and how can you do that if you don't know the history of what kind of innovations have happened in the past? I also think, beyond that, a theatre degree, like any liberal arts degree, is more than just the very specific skills that you're learning. It's about all that bigger picture stuff, you know? It's about actually taking a step back and considering your place in the world. What are the big ideas that are changing our world? And how do we communicate those ideas? And how do we work collaboratively with other people to communicate those ideas and to think deeply about them and to think critically about them? So it doesn't always mean literally going on to work in the theatre. A lot of our graduates go on to education, of course, but some of them go on to work in the public service, you know, in terms of if you can read a document and you can synthesize that information and then you can think about how to present that information in a compelling and engaging way, theatre's a great degree, or any liberal arts degree, of course, but it can really take you into all sorts of different situations. In fact, the former Premier of Queensland did drama at UQ. So you can go into politics if you want to.
And also coming back to what you're actually doing at the moment, personally, from my experience, one of your best units is got to be the Pitches and Partners, which is open not just to theatre, but it's also showing how we can use theatre in a wider spectrum of things that you can do.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone listening is considering enrolling in a unit at UNE, but yeah, Theatre 360 it's called. It's Pitches and Partners. And the whole idea really is to think about, okay, so you want to get a business idea up, you want to make an event happen. If you've got an invention, whatever you've got in any kind of industry, you're going to need verbal communication skills. You're going to need to make those partnerships happen. And when I was producing Machina, for example, I had to bring together a whole bunch of different sponsors. I had to work with different partners. And then, yeah, selling my car was like the absolute plan Z. But, you know, I had to use all of those theatre skills to make a big event happen. And those skills are, of course, transferable to any industry.
Now, coming back to personal experience, throughout the pandemic, you wrote a play called The Tiniest Thing. Similar to 25 Down and Machina, this play explores the issues of climate change through the lens of familial drama. Given that your work consistently calls back to this personal connection, do you believe viewing these big ticket issues through this lens makes your narratives more approachable?
I hope it does. But I guess the shorter answer is I don't know how else to write about things unless it's from a personal perspective. I really genuinely don't. So I have to find the personal way in. So if it's a big political idea like, I don't know, the clash of generations or what it means to live in the digital age or the specter of climate change, you know, where do you begin? For me, it has to go through my own personal experience and what's important to me. And with The Tiniest Thing, I was trying to draw some parallels there. So it's a family drama. I'd never actually written a family drama before. That was new for me. I always swore I would never write one because I've seen so many bad ones over the years. But I was reading an interview with an American playwright called Paula Vogel, and she was saying that sometimes it's useful to write what you hate. So find a form that you are frustrated with and try to breathe new life into it. Find your own personal way into making it work for you. So I thought, you know what, this is a challenge. I'm going to take this form, this family drama form, and I'm going to try to make it interesting for myself. So that was this first step, really, as a kind of personal challenge. And then I found myself writing this play, drawing parallels between climate change denialism and a family in emotional denial about something terrible that had happened within their family. So this sort of terrible thing that no one wants to talk about that's hovering over them. And obviously, that's the biggest horrible thing hovering over all of us at all times, really, apart from, I guess, the atomic bomb or whatever. But in general, climate change is the thing. How do we even approach it? And how do we get out of bed in the morning without being in some form of denial about it, you know? But I really wanted to find a connection there with those parallels, but I also wanted to find a way to reach people in the audience who perhaps are climate change denialists, people who actually are quite conservative in their views on that issue. Because I was sort of writing it for a main stage production, and I was thinking, okay, if I'm thinking, for example, of a Queensland Theatre Company audience, you know, I keep writing for my hometown even though I don't live there, but I was sort of thinking with that in mind, how do I reach an audience member who made their mind up in terms of how they feel about this issue? How can I find a way under their skin a little without beating them over the head with facts and figures? How can we find a way in through a more emotional story and finding those parallels and just not necessarily changing minds? I don't know if that's even possible in the theatre. That's an open question. Maybe you can over time, but I don't know if one play can do it. But even if it's just exposing some cracks in that kind of solid ideological wall, and some people do build walls around them and say, I'm not changing my mind in this position. And I like plays that make me reconsider my own views on things. So I, for example, might have very strong views about a particular issue. And if a play makes me question that or go, oh, have you considered the logic through which you've made that decision? Maybe the world isn't quite so black and white. For me, that's a really powerful thing that theatre can offer audiences. So that's what I was trying to do.
With that, the question is then, how do you get into their minds and into their skin without making it a worse experience? Like, how do you make it a constructive experience that they're not just going to feel this, but then just completely get blocked off from this and build up that wall even further? It's now just, what are we going to do with them now that we're under their skin?
That's a really great question. Working through it, I found that I had to find a place of hope by the end, but the hope had to be earned. So it couldn't be disingenuous. And the play hasn't been produced yet. I hope it does one day. But by the time I had the draft that was read out in New York, and then another draft I completed after that, I was really trying to work towards how do I find that hopeful ending that feels earned, that perhaps people who do disagree with each other can look towards together.
With The Tiniest Thing, you went on to win the Best New Play Award in the Australian Theatre Festival. Festival.
Yes.
And part of this prize included the chance to see your script stage in New York City.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that experience? Could elaborate.
Well, it was amazing. So, as I said, it hasn't had a full production, but it has had a public reading. So that's what happened in New York. So, yeah, it happened at the end of 2021. Mm. So the first big thing about it was that COVID was still around.
Mm.
And actually, we were still in lockdown in New South Wales when I got the opportunity to travel to New York. And they were still in and out of lockdown, of course, in New York as well.
Yeah.
And then they decided, you know what, we're going to stage it. Or we're going to have this festival. It was like a four-day festival in December 2021. Can you get over here? And I remember the borders, of course, to Australia were closed.
Mm.
And the borders reopened, I think, in November.
Yeah.
And so within the space of 3 weeks, I had gone from living in my living room for 5 months, or whatever our lockdown situation was here in Armidale, to booking my plane ticket and then flying to New York and being in the middle of Manhattan within 3 weeks. It was, whiplash. And no one was on the plane. You know, it was like me and the stewardess and, you know, two other people on this plane. It was so weird. Of course, masks everywhere, all the rest of it. But the other thing was I took a risk because if I had got COVID in New York, I would have had to pay $10,000 to pay for my own quarantine before they would let me back on the plane to come home. So there were all sorts of financial risks as well. But I was pretty determined to get there.
Yeah. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You're going to go with it.
It was. It was. And the festival was in Greenwich Village and I stayed nearby and I was there for 3 weeks. It was super exciting. And I attended rehearsals. And so basically it's a festival that's run by Australians who are based in New York City.
Okay.
So then they're looking for new Australian works, but they're also looking to give showcasing opportunities to Australian actors and production crew who are based in New York City to New York audiences.
Hmm.
So for me, it was such a wonderful experience because I met all these cool actors and cool crew who, you know, had moved halfway around the world and had sacrificed so much in their lives to make it in New York. Mm. And they were so thrilled to be telling an Australian story on a New York stage, which doesn't happen very often. So that was really fun. And the Australian Consul General in New York came, which is pretty cool. Nick Greiner, his name was. And oh, that's right. I met the sponsor of the award. So, of course, being America and the States, it's all privately funded.
Mm-hmm.
So they had sponsored the award and the prize money and my ability to go over there was sponsored by this wealthy American donor. I think he was a retired doctor or physician, they call them there. And I met my sponsor and I was like, thank you very much for supporting Australian theatre and for supporting me. You know, it's such a random thing for him to have done, but I was very, very grateful to him. And the reading itself, you know, we got a standing ovation and it was just a really exciting time. I learned a lot about seeing the play up on its feet and what was working and what in the back of my mind of like, oh, I still want to work on that or whatever, you know, because the play's never done in the playwright's mind.
No, of course.
And then finally, I remember an amazing after party. It was in Midtown with views of the Empire State Building. Like, you know, we were right up in the high in the clouds and it was the day before I flew home. So that was the one time, the whole time I was there, that I took my mask off and went, well, it doesn't matter if I get COVID now because I'll be on a plane by the time I get home. So, and I didn't get COVID. So it was really quite incredible.
Finally, looking forward into the future, you're currently working with the New England Regional Art Museum, or NERAM, on a project in response to their Hinton Collection. Can you give us a taster of what to expect?
Yeah, so the Hinton Collection is a permanent collection of artworks that essentially kicked off the New England Regional Art Museum, which was established in the early 1980s. So they celebrated their 40th anniversary last year. I think there's something like 200 individual artworks that were collected by Howard Hinton, who was a wealthy, gosh, was he a grazer? I should know this information. He was a wealthy man who lived in the area who collected these paintings in the early 20th century. So they were Australian artworks from the early 20th century, essentially. 1920s through to the 1950s, that kind of era. And all these artworks are housed in NERAM. The problem is, though, with any permanent collection is they sit there and now and again you go and have a look, but then they sit there and they sit there and they sit there and people lose interest because it's always the same thing. You know, there's always other exhibitions coming through and they're the interesting ones because it's always changing, whereas a permanent collection in any gallery is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
So galleries around the world are always looking for opportunities to breathe new life into these collections to re-engage the public. So I went to NERAM with this idea. I said, what if I wrote a series of monologues that are responses to these paintings? And then we filmed the monologues and we put a kind of QR code next to the painting so that when you went to the gallery, you scan your phone and you watch like a 4-minute monologue of someone talking to you as though they're in the painting and they've come alive and they're talking to you from the painting. And so we're just imagining the lives of the characters in the paintings.
Mm.
So that's the project. So I've chosen a particular painting as a pilot that mm-hmm. I'm writing, and I'm working with a local actress here. We're filming it in a few months. Mm-hmm. We're going to get that up. We're hoping to have that up and ready by May, I think, May or June. And that'll be housed on the NIRAM website, mm-hmm. as well as I mentioned, in the actual gallery space itself.
Of course.
But that's just the start. We want to actually work through a whole bunch of these. And actually mm-hmm. in trimester two, I'll be working with students here. Instead of a major production, we'll be actually creating responses to these artworks.
Wow.
Yeah, so that'll be a new, bold new territory for our on-campus students. And they don't know it yet, but I've just spoiled that.
There we go. Well, congratulations, trimester two on-campus students.
How can we bring this collection to life for the public using theatre and using really digital performance, essentially, because we're sort of going more into that space, which is also something we haven't done here much at UNE before.
If students are looking to get involved in this project and looking to get involved in the unit, what should they be looking out for?
Well, we'll put a call out towards the end of Try One. So yep. we'll sort of let people know about the project. And, you know, I'm happy to work with anyone who wants to work with us, really. We can work with their own ideas. I'll be writing stuff. I'd also like my playwriting students in Theatre 321 to write some stuff as well. So we're going to collect a whole bunch of different responses. We might do duologues as well, scenes between two actors as well. And we'll record them here in the media studios here at UNE. And, you know, they can hang around in the gallery for as long as the gallery wants to house them. So that's the other cool thing about them, that they can be a calling card as well. And students who work on them might even be able to use them in showreels if they want to.
Yeah.
Theatre, of course, is so ephemeral normally. So it's nice to have something we can create together that will be captured for a bit longer than just a few nights.
And what's the unit code for the major production unit again?
Thea 305.
There we go. So, yeah, if you're looking to formally get involved in the unit, yeah.
Yeah, just please contact me. Yeah, it'd be great.
That's about it. Thank you for coming and speaking with us. It's been a fantastic time speaking with you.
No problem at all. It's kind of fun to kind of look back on what I've done so far. And it makes me excited for what I might do next in terms of writing. You know, the nice thing about working in academia, you can have multiple careers. So if I can keep a playwriting career going at the same time as teaching, for me, that's going to be beneficial for my teaching as well as artistically rewarding. I hope that anyone listening to this or anyone studying theatre thinks about how they can do that in their own lives as well, because we don't just make a choice to become one person. Don't put yourself in a box. You know, you're not one thing or the other. If you want to keep up your practice, you can do it.
Well, thank you for coming and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Behind the Curtain with Nick Troon, recorded in Tune FM studios at the University of New England on Anawan Country. To view the latest episodes and Tune FM's other programs, visit tunefm.net or search Tune FM on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast fix. Finally, make sure you're following Tune FM on Facebook and Instagram for the latest updates on new episodes. That's it for today's episode. My name's been Nick, and I'll see you next time.